All right, so some of you may not know this, but if you have a program booklet, if you flip to the very, very back, there's a surprise for you. It's actually the next talks and what they're about and who the people are. So now you know, you thought, man, there's only two talks. We're really going to go all the way? No, that's back there. Okay, so I know usually you're not supposed to sneak to the end of the book, but in this case we're going to find out what happens next. First, though, I want to, I've made you aware of some of the things we have for sale over there, and don't forget to check that out afterwards. We'll still have people there, and these are discounted prices from what you can get online. I already went through and checked them all to make sure I can say that and be completely honest, and it is true. And we also have another table over there where nothing is for sale. There's one free thing you can get there, which is a geologic time scale, and it has the old Earth ages on one side and the a biblical timetable, how that might fit, an interpretation there. And these are brought here from Cornerstone Educational Supply. How many of you homeschool your kids? There's a few of you in here, and of course there's also a Christian school. You know, if you've been through school, which many of you have, that you take science classes at some point and you need science supplies. And Marcus Ross, who is a paleontologist, he's at Liberty University, he has started this organization to get good supplies, science supplies, to homeschool students, to schools, at an affordable price and from a biblical perspective. So it's a really cool company he has going there. Come over there, check out the rock samples and fossil samples we have. We'd love to talk to you about that so you can be aware of what's out there. And it's a, like I said, it's a really cool idea that he's got going, and he's doing some good stuff with it. So I want to go ahead and introduce our next speaker, who is my boss immediately, so I have to be careful about what I say. But he's a really good guy, and I am very thankful that he can be here with us. This is Dr. Joe Francis, who teaches at the Masters University. He is a microbiologist, and I'm sure he's going to have some interesting things to say to us about natural evil, creation biology, and the Christian witness.
Okay, thanks for sharing Matt with us. I know he's a guy who puts church and family first, so that means you are sharing with us, so thank you so much. I just want to give a quick shameless plug since we're talking about schools, but at the Masters University, I've been there 15 years, and I can tell you, this is the best thing about it, is our students. And I see another one right there. Hi. Okay. And it's a pleasure to work there. It's a pleasure to be in Christian education. But we need more. We need more. There are Christian schools across the country that are struggling. There's probably a Christian college closing about one a year now. We know it's expensive. We know there's lots of issues involved. Let me tell you a little bit about our science program, though. We've been involved in teaching biology and math for close to 50 years. It's 50 years, actually, for biology. And we've sent a lot of students to medical schools. A few years ago, to Johns Hopkins, the number two medical school in the country. He graduated a few years ago, and with his wife, who he found at the Masters University, she got her MSN degree in nursing. We do have pre-nursing. And they bonded at the college, and one of the things they bonded over was their interest in missions work, and they never stopped thinking about that. And Dr. Reisman and his wife, they spent the last couple years, well, he did a residency program after Johns Hopkins. They just spent over a year in France learning French. And as of about 6 days ago, they landed in Togo, West Africa, where they will both serve in the Hospital of Hope. And this is in the middle of Ebola country and all that, with their three little children. So that's an incredible story. And so we're so thankful that those students have that commitment. And but let me tell you this, we are looking at new programs. Geosciences will be starting next fall. Dr. McLean influenced so many people in the right way, even our president, that we're going to start a geosciences major in the fall, And so we're looking for students. And that encompasses a broad area. So if you're interested in the geosciences, even planetary sciences, you can talk to Dr. McLean even tonight. We're actually looking at pre-engineering also. We're looking at starting pre-engineering and moving toward in that direction. So if you're interested in all, contact me, Dr. Francis, Dr. McLean. Contact the school. We can set up a whole day just for you to visit the Master's University. Well, I need to probably explain my title to you. And I'm pretty sure I know I have ADD. So to put three concepts in a title like that is part of that. But let me begin in the beginning. What is creation biology? Creation biology is this idea among a lot of biologists who are Christians that we can base science on the Bible, that we can use that as a foundation. The Bible does use the word scientia in it in some interpretations where you can interpret to Latin. In Proverbs 2, it talks about knowledge or scientia, and that we can gain knowledge, that we're made to gain knowledge about our surroundings. But it's actually based on Proverbs 2 on the word wisdom. And wisdom comes from where? God, the very words of God. And so as scientists who are believers, we believe that we can do science based on a biblical foundation, and that God, and as that passage goes along, it talks about not only will you have knowledge if you understand who the creator is, who the designer is, but you'll have understanding and then even discernment. And that really gets close to a definition of what science is. Discernment is what? Making choices. In science, what do? You have data sets. You have lots of numbers and data sets and measurements, and you often have to choose. Does it mean this or does it mean that? The Bible can be used as a foundation for science. So we have creationists, we call ourselves creationists or creation biologists, who are developing something called a creation model. So we believe that we can do biology based on the Bible, and that's a creation model. For instance, some creationists of the past believed it was their job to basically show where evolution is wrong. And that's appropriate too, but if we spend all our time doing that, and people say, well, I see where evolution is wrong, what else do we have to offer them? What's our next question? Next question is, what does it mean to do science based on a biblical framework? So some of us are working on this model building. In biology, though, you find a lot of what's called natural evil. What is that? Natural evil is any kind of pestilence in our world that is caused by non-man-made, has a non-man-made cause, like storms, illness, and so on. And you find a lot of natural evil in biology. Venomous creatures. I was going to bring a little shell I forgot from my shelf today. One of the most venomous creatures is a little snail that lives on a shell and has about 100 toxins it can inject in you or the creatures it likes to eat. I can guarantee you it doesn't like to eat you, but it has 100 toxins. Why do snakes have venom? Why is there so much predation? That's natural evil. And say, well, I understand that as a believer. The world was a certain way once, and then there was the fall, and it changed. The problem with, and that is part of our answer. The problem with that is that in biology, it appears that some of this evil looks designed. It looks designed to do very bad things. How do we explain that? And then I want to relate that to the Christian witness, because as a teacher at a Christian institution, I believe it's my role to spur my students on to being a good witness. That's what we're supposed to do, right? To be a witness for Christ and to share the gospel. And I want to tie that in because a lot of people who have moved away from Christianity during their life did so based on this problem of natural evil. Why is there a God who allows suffering? And again, we can go back to our theology and say, there was a fall, and that's so important. That guides all of my biology, the creation and the fall. It's clear-cut, and as a young-age creationist, it's even more clear-cut, and it gives us, I think, better answers than some other views. But How do we explain some of these? How do we explain some of these natural evil things? And so, what I want to show you is that this is a reality. That this inability to understand natural evil does drive people away from God. And we brought up Francis Schaeffer. One of the things he said I thought that was important in the 1970s and 80s is that as believers, we need to develop answers to questions. We need to develop answers to the questions that our neighbor has. And so as a creation biologist, I'm really interested in saying, why does this design toxin exist? I can predict then that if everything was what in the creation week? Everything was very good, that maybe that toxin either wasn't there or it had a good purpose. It's hard for me to reason away that it wasn't there because some of these toxins and machines that creatures secrete to harm us or teeth, they're designed. They show design. So they were there. So how do we explain that? I remember in graduate school at lunch with a student, and she said, I know you're a Christian. I know because you leave early on Wednesday nights, and you're not here on Sundays. I said, wow, she figured it out. And so I was able to talk to her about that. But she said, I can't believe in your God because of suffering. And I tried to give an answer, and I think I gave one, but it could have been better. So in my training of students, I want them to develop an answer to that question. So that is the problem of natural evil. So what I want to talk to you tonight and show you, give you some examples of people who actually said they moved away from Christianity, even toward atheism, because of this natural evil problem. And I must tell you, I also have an interest in this area because I have atheist friends. And I want to be a good witness to them and answer their questions. And I just found out a few minutes ago that one of my friends is here tonight, and she is with the Santa Clarita Atheist and Freethinkers, I think she still is, Elizabeth, there she's raising her hand. She's here tonight, and we got to be friends a few years ago when we worked on a conference together called A Christian Response to Atheism. And welcome, Elizabeth. I'm glad you're here tonight. She found out on Facebook, too. So your advertising's working out there. That's good. This is there's a lot of atheists, and Elizabeth's making me think as I'm talking now because she's here, but we don't want to say that all atheists are a certain way in some circumstances. But I can tell you that a lot of reading I've done on atheism is that many have moved away from the church, were involved in the church, or brought up that way, moved away because of the issue of suffering, of natural evil. So Susan Jacoby is not one of the most atheist you might think about a lot, but she's a very good writer. And so she said this about her journey to atheism. Now, when students ask how I came to believe what I believe, I tell them that I trace my atheism to my first encounter at age 7 with a scourge of polio. In 1952, a 9-year-old friend was stricken by the disease and clinging to life in an iron lung. After visiting him in the hospital, I asked my mother, why would God do that to a little boy? She sighed in a way that telegraphed her lack of conviction and said, I don't know. The priest would say, God must have his reasons, but I don't know what they could be. She says this put her on a journey to atheism. Do you see the natural evil problem there? Yeah, it's illness. Is that fair? I think so. I think that's a fair question. Why do we have illness in a world if there's a good God around also? And we need to answer that question. Again, we can go back to our theology, and it is appropriate, and it does work. We can say there was something called a fall, and we always start with Scripture, and we can try to answer from that point of view. But as a biologist, I like to also, God also said in his word, you can study this natural world, and I believe he wants us to come up with answers also in that manner. Charles Darwin, yeah. He was a theologian. He was trained. His parents sent him to a seminary. He was a believer. He could have been had some issue of faith in his life. I don't know, on salvation where he was at. But if you look at his path, it was a slow path toward agnosticism and then atheism. In his writings, he said, "I don't understand this world. why do cats play with mice? And he said, why do we have something called the ichneumidae? So what's the ichneumidae? I might put some of my students on the spot here. The ichneumidae are those white eggs on this... That was somebody else, wasn't it? These white eggs on this green caterpillar. That's the ichneumidae. So what is it? Those are eggs from what kind of critter? A wasp. What is that wasp doing? They actually, these baby wasps will eat this caterpillar. They'll try to keep it alive while they're eating it. It's walking around being eaten. I don't know how much it feels and so on. What Darwin had a problem with. Is that fair? I think so. That's a good question. We also know that another event happened in his life that really possibly pushed him away from God. Who died? His daughter. There was a Hollywood movie made a few years ago. It's rather good. It's a little depressing because they go on for about 90 minutes about the death of his daughter. But why would you make a whole movie about the death of his daughter? It seemed to be a central part of his life. What if there was a theologian? What if there was a friend who could explain to Darwin why these things happen? Would it have helped? And then a more popular person in our culture, I don't know exactly where he was, maybe agnostic, atheist. Who's this? Steve Jobs. Yeah, the younger crowd gets it. I was driving, I tried to take each of my sons to Mammoth every year. It's been a couple years since we've done that. And one of them wanted me to listen to books on tape because it's a long drive, as you know. And we listened to this entire biography of Steve Jobs. He was an interesting man, brilliant. With his employees, he could be very ruthless and vulgar. It's hard to listen to some of it, but very interesting. He also had a journey that pushed him away from God regarding natural evil. He said this is what the author said about his experience. In July 1968, Life magazine published a shocking cover showing a pair of starving children in Biafra. Jobs took it to Sunday school and confronted the church pastor. If I raise my finger, will God know which one I'm going to raise even before I do it? The pastor answered, yes, God knows everything. Jobs then pulled out the Life cover and asked, well, does God know about this and what's going to happen to those children? Steve, I know that you don't understand, but yes, God knows about that. Jobs announced that he didn't want to have anything to do with worshiping such a God, and he never went back to church. He did, however, spend years studying and trying to practice the tenets of Zen Buddhism. Natural evil, clearly a story of natural evil. Who do we get into faulting anyone here? I don't know. The author of the book said the pastor probably should have understood. This is a very bright individual and needed a more in-depth answer, but I don't know. I just know that this idea of natural evil pushed Jobs away from faith, from the church. But what was interesting, and this is the sad part about it, is that he... And so one of the things I tell my students about witnessing to anyone is starting with Romans 1. Romans 1 says that no one has an excuse about what? About knowing who God is, right? Because they can see what? What does he put in nature? His power. His power. And you don't have an excuse. So in this same, I'm listening to this while we're driving, and I just blew my mind. In this same biography, the author talks about what drove Steve Jobs to go into the computer industry. He was actually living kind of a hippie lifestyle on communes. That's why the name Apple came out for his computers, because he joined these communes, I guess, in the 1970s and 80s, and part of what they did was eat one food. They would eat apples for months. That's all they ate. And that's where they got the term apple. And it is kind of, it makes you wonder, because he died of stomach cancer, too. But he ate apples. But he's on a farm. His parents are the ones who took him to church. They take him back to a family farm in Wisconsin, and he sees a calf being born. He sees the power of God in nature. Let me show you what he says. He saw a calf being born, and he was amazed when the tiny animal struggled within minutes and began to walk. It was not something she had learned, but it was instead hardwired into her, he recalled. He put it in hardware software terms. It was as if something in the animal's body and its brain have been engineered to work together instantly rather than being learned. He sees not only his reason for going, this is why he developed computers, not because of apples, it's like half. But do you see what he saw? He saw something miraculous. An animal getting up and walking after it's born. He saw the miracle of creation in that animal. He saw God's power. This is what's so ironic. God's witness is here to him, but he had already moved away from the faith because of natural evil. Here's what's interesting. Near the end of his life, when he had cancer, the author of the book interviewed him and said, "Where are you on this issue?" He said, "Some days I'm on the side of thinking about God. Other days I think it's just a switch that goes off." And here's what he said. He said, "But I don't like the idea of a switch going off. That's why I didn't put any on-off switches on my phones." You know that? I don't have my phone with me, but you can't turn it off, right? You have to do all these things to turn it off. You ever thought about that? There's no deliberate, obvious on-off switch. So I don't know. I don't know where he ended up before God. So let's talk more about natural evil and how, as a creation biologist, we can look at this problem in that light and look at some possible solutions. I'm a microbiologist, so I study microbes. What are microbes? Bacteria and viruses and fungus and all those sorts of things. And I talk about this a lot. And what do you think about when you hear bacteria and viruses? You start feeling sick, right? Yeah, it's like, wow, I don't want to talk about it. And bacteria have been causing scourges, and viruses have been causing scourges for centuries. It's in our history books. And again, could we just say, well, at the fall, these bad bacteria showed up? The problem is, when I look at bacteria, I find incredible designs. Two major designs. They are secretion machines. They're made to secrete things. They have, and these protein machines are made of 5, 10, 15, 20 proteins. They're incredibly beautiful. They have motors. You've heard of the flagellum, this acid-driven rotary motor? Yeah, it's a machine. It is designed. I don't think these things appeared at the fall. I think they were there during the creation week. They're incredible machines that we can't even figure out how to create because they're at the sub-nano level. They're so small. So how do we figure this out? Why do things that make us sick, why were they designed in the first place? Well, I started just doing some math, and we think there's 10 million species of bacteria on the earth. That's just species. Some say 30 million species of bacteria on the earth. How many do you think actually make you sick? There's streptococcus, you have a strep throat, right? Staph infections, E. coli. Some E. coli can make you sick. Most of it's actually good in your gut. There's just some bad E. coli out there. How many species of bacteria do you think can make you sick that we have documented? About 400. That's a pretty low percentage, isn't it? That's our thing with that. What are those other 99.9% of bacteria doing? And by the way, that's 10 million species. If you look, they've calculated the number of bacteria on the earth, Dr. Lyle, and I think it's somewhere in the area of 10 to the 29th, and it is a bigger number than all the stars. Sorry. But I'd rather look at the stars. But there's more bacteria than stars. So I started thinking, what are all these other bacteria doing? We should be dead if there's 10 million species out there that could be attacking us at any minute. And here's the thing I found. About 90-plus percent of them are involved in recycling. Every element you can think of, carbon, cesium, lead, is being recycled in our world, especially the ones that promote life, are being recycled. They are huge recycling reagents. They work with fungus and algae to make lichens. You've seen lichens on rocks? You know what lichens do? They look like they're not doing anything. They're very sensitive to pollution. They're not at our level. You have to go up in the mountains. They're actually breaking down rocks. What is that doing? That's putting what in the soil? Minerals. It's promoting life. So I wrote a paper a few years ago that most bacteria are part of a life-supporting biomatrix that I think that God put in place possibly day one, day two, or day three in the soil. It's a life-supporting matrix, and it's there. The ones that cause illness are very rare. Does that solve the design problem? No. No, there's still these machines that appear to be causing us great harm. But that's kind of cool that creationists can say, I predict that they have to be doing something good. That's what he said in the beginning. And greater than 99% appear to be doing that. So that's an article and answers in Genesis you can look up online. Then I started looking at some individual cases that were really tough. Cholera. Cholera has been around for centuries. The latest outbreak, I think, is Haiti. If the bacteria you're looking at is down at the lower left, your lower left here, it's called Vibrio because Vibrio means curved. It's called a curved rod. It has a flagellum. There's that motor, all designed to do bad things in a lot of creatures, especially the human gut. And so I started looking at cholera. And let me just summarize, though. Cholera is a part of a whole group of bacteria called Vibrio. And when I started looking at all the Vibrios, there's Vibrio fischeri, Vibrio hemolyticus, Vibrio cholera, most of them live on crustaceans. What are crustaceans? Shellfish, right? Shellfish. Most of them live on crustaceans. And in fact, most of those species are all over the ocean critters that you swim by that have outer shells, exoskeletons. And what do you think they're doing? They're designed to hang onto that shell and not harm the animal until it... They don't harm the animal at all, but when it dies, what do you think they do? They recycle that skeleton, that exoskeleton, putting carbon and nitrogen back into the ocean. A huge recycling project. I thought, yes, does Vibrio cholera do that? Well, I looked at all the toxins of Vibrio cholera, and you can fill up a page with the toxins. Most of them are involved in that recycling. So some of the toxins that make us sick are involved. I said, I've got it. But I couldn't figure out one toxin, the actual toxin called the cholera toxin. It's the one that makes you so sick that you can die within a few hours. And so what the cholera toxin does is it makes the human body lose a lot of water fast. So, this pink is a cell in your intestine. Okay? Good thing we ate, right? Good thing. Okay. This is another pink one. They're all lined up, beautifully lined up in your intestine. Here's the inside of your intestine. You've ingested some Vibrio cholera. That's how you get it. You ingest it in usually dirty water, unsanitary conditions. Vibrio cholera, here it is. It's supposed to be curved. Here's its tail. Here's the cholera toxin that I can't find a purpose for in nature. It goes inside your intestinal cell, and it is so devious and so well designed. Here's what happens. Cell biology, how many students here are taking biology or cell biology? You could admit it. I won't ask you directly. Okay, good. Okay, I know some students over here, and some had the class. Okay. What do cells, all the cells in your body, what are they doing all the time? One big project they're involved in. Not just cell division, but what do they make? Proteins. Who said proteins? Okay. I usually have gifts. I don't have any today, but you'd receive one. Okay, so Dr. McLean has one for you. They make proteins. Your cells are protein factories because proteins make life work. It's not the DNA. DNA just holds the information. So these proteins are made in the center of your cell by your nucleus. They go through all these membranes, and they're sent out around the cell and sometimes to the outside world. But the cholera toxin actually tells the cell, I'm one of your proteins, but make me go backwards. It's called retrograde protein motion. This is designed. It tells your cell, take me and go backwards into the interior. It goes all the way into the interior of the cell, into a trap membrane where the proteins, other proteins, are just being made. And it finds itself trapped. It actually wants to go up here. It actually wants to go up here and poison this channel, which releases what? What is, okay, students, what is Cl negative? Chloride anion, right? Negatively charged. Remember that? Anion is negatively charged. Chloride. So your cells actually have to move chloride in and out. You've heard of chloride, right? Because you've heard of sodium what? Chloride. Your cell, you're bathed in sodium chloride salt solution, right? And that those ions are being moved out of your cells all the time. They do that for work. Other things can be hooked to it. Anyway, you have a chloride channel, and the collar toxin is trying to get over here to poison it. It can't go any other route because it has to get to this switch right here. This switch turns on the chloride channel. And it can only go by that retrograde motion. But it gets trapped in an inner membrane where the other proteins are being made. It's got to get out. It even gets more devious. Where in this inner membrane system where your proteins are just being made, your proteins have to fold correctly. One of the secrets of all of life is protein folding. Okay? So we probably should all be better at folding our clothes and things like that. It's very important. Protein folding. It's amazing. We have supercomputers just trying to figure out this problem. Proteins don't work unless they're folded into this ball-shaped thing. Very intricate. Well, in the center of your cell where you're making proteins, if there's unfolded proteins, they get sent out and chopped up. So the cholera actually unfolds and says, here I am. I need to get out. Your cell sends it out, and then before it gets to the chop-up machine, it refolds. Do you see how devious this is? It's so devious. And then it goes over to this switch called adenylate cyclase, and it turns it on permanently. So what comes out all the time? Chloride, way too much. That has to be turned off and on, not on all 24 hours a day. So if your cells start kicking out all this chloride into your intestine, what's going to follow? Sodium likes to attach to it, so sodium chloride keeps coming out. What's going to follow that? Water. Water. So much water comes out that you can be dehydrated within a few hours. You can die of dehydration. This is a horrible death. We should be very concerned about people that have cholera because it's one of the few illnesses where you're not actually feeling that sick. You're wide awake. Okay? At least some of the illnesses that will take us will be so out of it, it'll be merciful in some ways, okay, if you got that sick, but not this one. You're fully awake, and you can die within a few hours. So it's a horrible... And so this toxin looks designed. How in the world do we explain that in this world? So I was reading about this, really curious. I was baffled why there could be a toxin, and there's a lot more out there that a lot of us haven't figured out. And I ran into this work by Dr. Rita Caldwell. And she's one of the most brilliant scientists I know because George Bush, one of the presidents, one of the Georges, I think it was the second one, appointed her as the head of the National Institutes of Health. That's how many papers she's published. Very brilliant. Guess what? She worked on cholera. So I started reading her work, and I found a paper in 1986. And buried in that paper, she says, I've been studying cholera for years, and what I've noticed is Vibrio cholera is in all our oceans. It likes to bind to crustaceans. But I found it in the gut of the blue crab. She finds it in the gut of the blue crab. That's really curious. And I started reading more, and she goes, here's what's interesting. Wherever I find cholera in the world, it's most concentrated in brackish water. Where do you find brackish water? Between what two bodies of water? Salt and, or fresh water and salt water, right? It's called brackish water. And she goes, this is interesting because the blue crab, and some animal, can all animals move from fresh water to salt water? No, they'll die because they have to process the salt. Guess what? The blue crab is one that can. Are you catching on to the story here? The blue crab, she's finding, is moving through this brackish river-like estuary, they call it. It's picking up cholera into its gut. It's going into the high salt ocean. What does it need to get rid of? Salt. The cholera toxin probably helps it get rid of. She never went on to prove that. And I emailed her and said, why didn't you do that? She said, it was too expensive to do it. But and she didn't have a really good reason. She wrote back and said, why are you interested? And so isn't that interesting? That the cholera toxin in the blue crab, if we can prove it, probably has a good function to help that crab live in the ocean. But then you might ask, why in the world? Matt, is there another clock? I don't know if I got watches. What do you have? 6:35? Okay. Is there a clock up there? Okay. Oh, way up there. Okay, got it. I didn't know if my clock was about to slow down. So, but why would God make a toxin? And by the way, the few cholera cases we have a year are from people eating blue crabs. So make sure you cook it really good, okay, if you like blue crab. I think it's mostly on the East Coast where they eat it. And but then I looked at cholera. Cholera is known as a pandemic, but it's not really. Pandemic means what? Found all over. You'd have disease all over. We don't have cholera here. It tends to be found in Bangladesh every year. It's in Haiti right now. I found out it's really actually, you have to have certain conditions to get it. You actually have to have certain weather patterns because in the ocean, its population is controlled by a virus that keeps it in check. In Bangladesh, every year, monsoons come in the spring. They dilute the viruses that control it. The cholera cases go up. Also, if you've swum, who has been swimming off our beaches here on the ocean? Have you swallowed a little water? If you have, you swallowed cholera, probably. None of us are getting sick. Why? You have to have a lot of it. And some Vibrio don't have the toxin. It's actually very difficult. And the good news is, there is a hospital, I think it's in Bangladesh right now. This came out, I saw it in the New York Times a year ago. There's a hospital that has 100% cure rate for cholera. Guess what it is? It's called hydration and patient care. It turns out that most people die from cholera because they get to the doctor too late and they don't know how to treat the patient. And all you need to do is make sure. But think about that. It's not easy because if you're sick to your stomach or gut, you don't feel like eating or drinking anything, right? You have to get water into the patient. They have this hospital, I wish I had a slide for you, has 100% success rate. It can be stopped. It's not as evil as we think it is, except if it kills you, it is pretty evil, right? But it can be reversed. And patient care, that's a real clue about what we do in medicine, I think. So I believe probably in the perfect garden, cholera had its role in the oceans as a recycler, possibly helping animals go from fresh to salt water, and then certain weather conditions in our world displaced it. So I came up with a theory about this matrix. I came up with this theory about microbial natural evil, that God did make some things have a good function here, but when they're over here, they can cause harm. I call it displacement theory. Or God made good things in the garden here, and they were modified somehow as time went at the fall, and they can cause illness. And that seems to be catching on among other creationists. But we have a lot to do. We have a lot to do. Now, here's what's interesting. I found another thing related to this to help explain the possible story even more. Does anybody see this critter right here? Anybody been to Hawaii lately? That's a squid. It can fit in your hand. It's about 2 inches long. That's the Hawaiian bobtail squid. It lives in the sand off the beaches of Hawaii in about 2 feet of water. It's so small, it's afraid of getting eaten by the day, so it burrows in the sand. At night, it comes out to get food. But wait a minute. Even in the shallow water, some small sharks can come in. And how do they tell if there's prey above them? This goes back to astronomy. How can they tell if there's prey above them? They see a shadow against the stars. So this little Hawaiian bobtail squid makes light under its belly. And it's swimming, and the shark's going, that's a funny-looking moon, but I'll let it go. You know, that's fine. I'll bypass that. It's called counter-illumination. But this squid doesn't do it by itself. So you probably know the rest of the story now. How does it make light? From a bacteria and one of the Vibrios. It makes light from one of the Vibrios. There's a whole another hour I could tell you about how it does it. But let me just summarize. It gets it into a light organ, and it would be really inefficient to make light all day long, and it would keep you up. So it only makes light at night. And how does it do that? The bacteria, when they grow to a certain number, they communicate with each other. It's called quorum sensing, okay? Baptist Church, you should know about quorums, right? In your committees, right? Got to have a quorum to pass a vote. At least we used to. Okay, so these bacteria grow more at night. They send out a quorum, says, let's make some light. I have no idea why. What benefit to them? And the Hawaiian bobtail squid has light. It's called counter-illumination. But here's what they have to do. they'll get so many bacteria in there, it'll stop the light. So they have to release it. Do you see where I'm going there? There's toxins that, when we have cholera, make the human body lose so much water. Vibrio fischeri has some of those same toxins that help eliminate the excess bacteria. So there's another possible role for some of the toxins. But here's what I should explain more. Vibrio fischeri, the bacteria that live in this critter, and the Vibrio cholera, they share some DNA sequences of those same toxins. And the Vibrio fischeri is not killing this wine bobtail squid. It's helping it live. And there's a whole other story about predation, right? We don't have time. Well, you know, why did God make sharks to eat Hawaiian bobtail squids? That's another lecture. We'll go there another time. Well, let's keep going because I got a few minutes. So here's the two ideas I'm working on, and I hope others can work on it, that God made good things. And it kind of fits, Dr. Varner mentioned weeds or thorns and thistles. Yes, they came up in the garden. But I will also look, Dr. Varner, when I look at thorns and thistles, I believe that they weren't a product of the fall, but I believe their overgrowth was a product of the fall. They were there for a purpose, meaning that they might have got displaced, right? Displacement could just mean growth. The example I've used in class for many years is that my comb, which I don't use very much, right? My comb is harmless. It's a good thing. I don't even need it. But if it grows to 60 feet tall and it's laying over the five, it's crashing. Cars are crashing, right? So just growth could, and so thorns and thistles. So I feed birds, and you can feed them little thistle seeds, but it's probably not good to have a 12-foot thistle sitting in your feeder. They're getting impaled on it, right? So growth can even be involved. So it's got a few more examples, and still looking for the clock, but I'll find it. Okay. So here's another one. What about viruses? They are actually more difficult. Viruses are more difficult to explain. In fact, I told Dr. Lyle that there's more bacteria on Earth than stars. Every bacteria has at least 10 different viruses growing in it. So the most numerous creature on Earth is this lowly little virus that we hate so much. Okay? That's an electron microscope image. Microscopic image. Okay, but I want to tell you a story about what this virus does. This virus is called a cyanophage, and it attacks bacteria called cyanobacteria. Cyano means color, and so these bacteria are green. You see each bacterial cell? There's a cell, there's a cell, there's a cell. Do you see each one? Those are all different cells. They kind of stick together. They look like seaweed in the ocean. This is predicted to be the most abundant bacteria in the ocean and probably the world. It grows as mats. The astronauts in the space station, when they come around certain parts of the ocean where it's warm, they can see it from space. So blooms of it are so big and green. They can see it from space. This little virus, which you could probably put several hundred around the outside of each bacteria, let's mentally draw them, okay? Hundreds of them can land. They actually have landing gear right here. And what do? Many of them will blow up bacteria and control their population. But that wouldn't be good for this bacteria, because this bacteria is probably the most populous bacteria on Earth, the most numerous bacteria on Earth, and it's green. So students here, if you have a green cell, what is it probably doing? Photosynthesis. This is probably the number one photosynthetic agent in the ocean. What does photosynthesis do? It brings energy into any living system, but it also grabs carbon, okay? Think about that. We're worried about global warming, putting carbon in the air. This thing could actually reverse it, okay? It's called carbon fixation. So all the critters in the ocean rely on this food web from this cyanobacteria. It's the most abundant. It rivals the plants on the earth with carbon fixation, bringing carbon and photosynthesis. That's how much it is. But think about this for a minute. If you're a cyanobacteria and you need light to make your energy and get the carbon out of the air, do you need it to be at the bottom of the ocean or at the top? Top. Okay, think about it. Think about yourself as a cyanobacteria right now, and you're laying on top of the water all day. What's going to happen to you? you're really going to get sunburn. Happens to cyanobacteria. The proteins that are going and being involved in photosynthesis get sunburned. What do viruses do? Viruses are little genetic engineers. They can grow inside cells by injecting their DNA. So this little spaceship, which has the DNA up here, lands on a cell with its tail, injects DNA, and they found out in this model, cyanophage virus actually can put back the genes of the sunburn proteins. It can actually restore the sunburn proteins. This is a paper written up. It's published. It's not fable. This little virus, so get me here on this. The food web of the entire ocean is probably dependent on this photosynthetic bacteria. And it can't work unless it has this. This little thing is probably supporting, without this creator, life in the ocean might crash. That's a prediction. You think about, isn't that like our God, though, to choose the small, helpless things sometimes to demonstrate his power? Now, I haven't solved all the viruses. There's still a lot of mystery about viruses, but there's a lot that live on you that don't cause you to be ill. Okay. There's the clock. It's in red letters. I was looking for an analog. I'm so old, I was looking for hands and, you know, this kind of thing. Okay. So, I started at six, right? So I have a few more. I've opened up for questions. I've been studying bark beetles, and I'll just say this quickly. We got a grant to study bark beetles, and I can tell you this creature is designed to get under the bark of trees, and it looks like it's designed to kill them. Why in the world does this creature exist? We have a rancher in Colorado. He gave us $30,000 about 4 years ago to study the bark beetles. We went to Colorado. We went to California. We have a study site up in the mountains here in Mount Pinos. And what I found is that in a healthy forest, they're everywhere. Not just a forest where trees are falling over, they're everywhere. And the forest I'm working on, these bark beetles are actually selecting only trees that blow over. Not only that, we were collecting these bark beetles. Most all of you are from California here, so you know we just had a 4 or 5 year drought. And some of us think they're really ugly, but look at the colors that beetles can display. A lot of beauty there. By the way, this is the most numerous variety of species of any animal on the earth is beetles. God has a sense of humor too, right? So these bark beetles can kill trees if they're overpopulated. If they're underpopulated, they can do this. We studied water in a high desert forest for an entire spring, summer, fall. The yellow is the water content of a stream bed going almost to zero. The magenta there, reddish, is from a slash pile of sticks. It does go to zero. The blue, this is moisture in the forest floor. This is the fourth year of the drought at 8,000 feet. There's just no water. We put our moisture probe under the bark of a fallen tree that was full of bark beetles. What bark beetles do? They'll chew and they'll spit it out and they make a beautiful like sponge. So you think, I know you know where I'm going. The water stayed constant under the bark. The first year we did this, in the second year of the drought, my students picked up the bark and water just flowed out. The floor was completely without water. And we found all sorts of insects in there. It was a food web. These little bark beetles were actually water engineers. They were helping to promote water and life in the drought. It turns out when they're overpopulated, they can kill live trees. We're still working on that theory. So here's my conclusions. Creation biologists suggest that remnants of God's original good designs can be found in nature and suggest that natural evil can result from good designs gone bad or creatures in the wrong place, as we talked about. Ultimately, the problem of natural evil is due to man's sin. We can say that natural evil is not man-caused, but we know ultimately we caused it, right? Because we, as Dr. Barner was talking about, Francis Schaeffer said, nature became divided against itself due to man's sin. And because creation is recent, creationists can expect remnants of God's good creation all around us. This is what's exciting to be a young Earth creationist. The Earth isn't that old. I don't think we're going to solve every problem. But I think we're going to find more examples of what looks evil that it was actually once good. And that's my talk. Thank you.
Okay, so we're going to have a few questions if you want to take them. Or I can answer. I mean, I'm people here now, so I'll just take your questions. Yeah. You have any questions for Dr. Francis? Always that question of, like, is that person going to the bathroom? Or is it a question? You don't know. Getting some coffee.
She's getting something to drink. Okay. Yeah, there's one. Drink. Okay, we got one coming.
Are you maintaining that all the animal life that we have here today, God created in Genesis 1? Or so are you denying natural selection and macroevolution?
Yeah, we didn't get that. Wasn't the purpose of the talk, but and it would be another talk, and I don't know if you're going to go there. We don't deny the mechanism of natural selection, but in our model, because the Earth is recent, it wouldn't have time to cause major evolutionary events. According to Dr. Kurt Wise, Harvard-trained biologist and creationist, he believes that what happened is when after the fall, resources became few, animals had to fight to obtain those resources. During the battle, the stronger survived, but there wouldn't be enough time for evolution. Now, on the other side of that, as creationists, we do believe in speciation. We believe that God built into the certain created kinds ability to change over time. So there might have been an original cat kind, and all the cat kinds today have come from that. But we don't believe it originally involved natural selection, because natural selection involves death, and we don't believe God used death to create. I know there's a lot there, but
there are other reasons that animals can change. I guess I am going to answer your question. There you
go. Yeah, go ahead.
No, you're a good job. But just to add on to that, natural selection isn't the only thing that can drive change in organisms. You can have sexual selection, would be one where animals are choosing mates and that affects things. And even just in the movement into new environments can cause that. And that could have even happened even in a world without sin.
Right.
Those kinds of things could have been happening.
Sure. You can follow up if you'd like. I don't know if that helps answer your question.
Yeah, I think you answered it.
There are people who call themselves creationists, evolutionary creationists, who do believe in a full natural selection model of evolution. But that's not our model.
It just seemed like you're like even the little tiny virus, like you I assume you're maintaining that God created that virus for the specific purpose of helping the bacteria in the ocean.
It appears that way,
yeah.
But there also could be secondary purposes, and I think it's more complicated. A creature could have been designed to have one function, and now in the fallen world, it has another function that still helps. And so our theory still needs testing, okay? But the idea is, yeah, we're looking for remnants of that good. Trying to figure out when it occurred is difficult, but I would say that virus in the beginning had some good role because it said it was all good.
Right, but you wouldn't say that it evolved from like something else, right?
I would say that viruses came from viruses, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Good question, thank you. Yeah.
Yeah, I had a question regarding the fall, and you mentioned evidence of design in things which we would call mostly natural evil. What I've always thought is that in the fall, God did design amazing natural evil things because it was a curse. Same amazing God who does amazing things, but did an amazing fall. In other words, if I can put it that way. In other words, I don't see design as evidence that it had to be necessarily in Genesis 1.
Right. There could... We're,
so, yeah,
as young age creationists, we're a bit bound, and Dr. I think Lyle mentioned this too, is that most physical creation that we know about stopped on day 6. It seems to apply all of it stopped then. It doesn't mean, though, Dr. Wood and others have talked about mediated design, where God, in his forethought, built things into that original creation so that at the fall, one thing got knocked off and then the other mechanism worked. But what we don't believe is a large second creation. The Bible doesn't talk about that. Yeah.
Okay, I see your point. In other words...
But it was a dramatic event that changed so many things.
Right.
But that change, I think, would have to be mostly in what was already made.
Okay, I got you. So you're saying that when you said design, you meant the original creation.
Yeah.
When you said design.
Right.
So somehow there had to be something in that design
right.
that could then be maligned
right.
or
right.
changed somehow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks.
It's a good question.
So I think we can just do one more.
Yeah. Sure.
I wanted to ask if you could tell me something good about cancer cells.
Mm.
And you know, we hear a lot about cancer cells are caused, let's say, for instance, by smoking.
Mm-hmm.
Right, they see a link from smoking to developing lung cancer. But then there are people who develop lung cancer and they've never smoked. You know, so are you saying that the cancer cells existed, you know, way back in the
yeah,
first
good.
6 days?
Excellent question. Cancer cells, there's no such thing as a cancer cell by itself. All cancer cells are derived from our own tissues. So what happens is all our cells divide, and here's another incredible machine. Our cell division is like clockwork. There's all these protein machines that make it divide just on time or tell it to stop dividing. In cancer, some of those machines break down, our cells become cancerous. So that is some. So that's a breakdown, and that would that happened after the fall. We had illness and pain. And so cancer cells come from our own good cells. They're actually they're affected by the fall, so some of their processes stop working.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So we're going to take a little break. Just 5 minutes. Actually, I guess just 4.